Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to talk this afternoon on the scientific studies and meditation. So I want to talk first about why we bother with scientific studies. They're expensive, time-consuming, but are considered a valuable way of evaluating whether something is good or bad. And if it is good, what it's good for. A lot of studies are done today, and they do have their problems. They are poorly conducted studies that are used to market things that are really just telling something that's not true. And there are other studies that are really well done and reliable. So we'll be talking a little bit about the quality of studies as well this afternoon in relation to meditation. I want to give you our definition of meditation again from the Oxford Dictionary. So it is to think deeply or focus one's mind for a period of time in silence or with the aid of chanting for religious or spiritual purposes. Again, it's a fairly broad definition. I'm going to give you my conclusions before we go through these studies. The reason for that is there's that many studies that have been done on the subject of meditation that it is impossible to even cover probably 10% of them. And every study, in order to understand just one single study, you have to go through quite a lot of explanations. So in order to try and get the most value for time out of this presentation, I'm going to start by a kind of summarizing, and then as we go through, you can check what you think of my conclusions. Okay, I want to mention again that I hold to the premise that there are two basic types of meditation. There is what I call faith-based active meditation, and then there is mystical trance meditation, and we will define those for you again. So faith-based active meditation is where we're using the frontal lobe, our logic, our reason, to evaluate external material for the purpose of building ourselves up, for the purpose of learning and growing and providing comfort. And it is best illustrated, in my opinion, by faith-based prayer and meditation on scripture. And I'm going to use the term active meditation in this talk for faith-based meditation. Second type of meditation is sensory-focused trance meditation, which I called mystical meditation in a previous talk. And this is characterized by an altered state of consciousness. It is also characterized by a dominance of hindbrain wave activity, alpha and theta waves, which I'm going to show you a study from. And it's well demonstrated by Hindu transcendental meditation, Buddhist mindfulness meditation, and self-hypnosis. So I'm going to use trance meditation for this second type. So you've got active meditation and trance meditation are our two types that we will be talking about. Those are the two names I'm going to give them. This first study I want to give you is just to illustrate the point I just made, that trance-based meditation is similar to self-hypnosis. This is a study done in 1975, so it's an older study. It's called a controlled study of an EEG. That stands for a long name. It just means checking the brain waves. A controlled study of an EEG during transcendental meditation comparison with hypnosis. And this is from their abstract. An abstract with a scientific study just means a summary giving the nuts and bolts of what they have done and what they have found. trends towards increased theta and decreased beta activity during meditation were apparent. Beta activity is frontal lobe stuff. And this is the abstract continued. The EEG characteristics of a group of meditators were similar to those of a group of subjects experienced in self-hypnosis. So basically the same technique that is used. A body of scientific literature exists for both active meditation and trance meditation. It's quite large on both sides. And when you look at that literature, you can find supporting material to show that active meditation is good for you and also that trance meditation is good for you. And in the literature on both sides, there is also negative aspects. So we're going to look at all this today. We're going to look at the positive aspects of trance meditation, then the negative, then we'll look at the positive aspects of active meditation, and then the negative aspects of active meditation. And then we will summarize. Remember that both these types of meditation are connected to a wider context, particularly a religious context. Meditation has come to us primarily through religion. I want to mention something about the quality of studies. Quite a few of the studies I'm going to present today have been evaluated for quality in this book, which is a very interesting book. Handbook of Religion and Health. It's a second edition, 2012. I have a copy of this book. It's a very thick book and has a lot of information on studies to do with health. And they do a very good quality rating, which is why I like using that book. And so most of these studies, well, in fact, all of them are 6 to 8, which are it's very hard to get a 9 or a 10. I've never seen a 10 out of 10 study. So the higher the rating, the better the study. And the way they evaluated that is on page 608 of that book by Koenig and others. There is something else in relation to studies which I alluded to yesterday, the p-value, which refers to probability. The way this p works is that the lower the value, the more significant was the finding. So the more likely it is that it's true. Okay, what they're saying. If a p-value is high, it means the probability is high that there has been a possibility that they might not be correct. Okay, so we want small p-values for our studies if possible. I did mention yesterday too that these four aspects that we need to have, these four areas that we need to evaluate in order to make a decision about meditation, and today we're going to do number four, results of scientific studies. Okay, let's launch into them. Studies in which trance meditation results were positive. We're going to look at cancer and trance meditation to start with. This is a study done in 2004, has a quality level 7 out of 10 by Carlson and others. They examined the effects of an 8-week Buddhist-based mindfulness stress reduction program on salivary cortisol, DHEA, and melatonin levels in 42 cancer patients in Calgary, Canada. No significant differences were found in hormone levels after the 8 weeks, but the 42% who had abnormally high cortisol to begin with appeared to show a shift to more normal patterns. So they didn't get a great positive finding after their initial 8-week period. However, at follow-up, there was some more positive results. Outcomes were assessed at 6 and 12 months. This was a later study, 2007, and cortisol levels had decreased significantly at 8 a.m., 2 p.m., and 8 p.m. in those who were doing the Buddhist-based mindfulness meditation. Okay, so that was, you could argue that that was a positive result. We didn't get a p-value for that. There wasn't one in the study that I found in the abstract. So cortisol is a stress hormone, and it's good to have levels that are not too high. I mean, they can go too low as well, but the assumption here is that these were normalizing. Here's another study that is in relation to transmeditation and cancer. This is a 2005 study, so quite recent as well. They were using Hindu-based transcendental meditation. This was examined in a randomized clinical trial to assess the effect of cancer mortality in 77 white older adults living in homes for the aged in Boston. They were randomized for subjects to either TM, Buddhist mindfulness meditation, or a usual care control group. So they're actually using two types of transmeditation and a control group. They also conducted a similar trial, a sister trial, with Afro-Americans, 125 of those, and they combined the data from both studies. Subjects were followed from 9 to 19 years, so it's a long study. And there was a weak trend favoring survival of those in the TM groups compared to those in the other active therapy groups. So TM did better than mindfulness, Buddhist meditation, and better than the normal care group over this 19-year period, with a p-value that is actually quite high. 0.09 is quite a high p-value. It's not that significant, but it's positive. What about transmeditation and coronary heart disease? Well, there's been quite a few studies on this. I'm going to talk about the more recent studies, which include two clinical trials. Of these two clinical trials, one found significant positive cardiovascular effects. This is a 2009 study, and one clinical trial of higher quality, 8 out of 10, reported marginally significant positive results. We'll have a look at this Paul Labrador 2006 study in more detail. Then there was three experimental studies as well, which are not quite as good type of study, which didn't have control groups. And of these three, one found a significant effect on baroreflex sensitivity after repetition of an Ave Maria in Latin or a yoga mantra. That's a 2001 study. Another recorded a slight improvement in brachial artery vasoreactivity after 6 weeks of yoga. And the remaining study found nil effect on heart rate variability after 10 weeks of TM practice. So it's not that fantastically positive, but there are some marginal positive benefits being found here in these recent studies. We'll have a closer look at the best of these studies, a higher quality clinical trial by Paul Labrador and others. 8 out of 10, that's a good quality study. Effects of a randomized controlled trial of transcendental meditation on components of a metabolic syndrome in subjects with coronary heart disease. So this was a 16-week randomized trial to test the effect of TM versus health education in 103 meditative naive subjects with stable coronary heart disease in Los Angeles. And they measured this thing called heart rate variability and brachial artery vasoreactivity. They're just technical terms for two things that relate to good quality coronary heart health. They did quite an intensive program too. I mean, just imagine if you were one of these subjects in this experiment. This is what you had to do. TM consists of 3 hours of lectures, a 10 to 15 minute personal interview, 1.5 hours of personal instruction, 3 1.5 hour group meetings, a 1.5 hour follow-up and maintenance meetings twice weekly for 4 weeks, then weekly for 12 weeks, and practice of TM for 20 minutes twice a day. So it's pretty intensive. The control group had equivalent times for individual and group health education sessions, and the results showed a slight P0.07 increase in the high frequency component of heart rate variability, a positive effect. No effect was seen on brachial artery vasoreactivity. So this study on trance-based meditation is a good quality study, 8 out of 10, conducted in an intensive fashion, found a probability that is low that their positive results were positive, in fact, okay, slightly positive. So it is a positive result, but an intensive program. Okay, this is another positive study for trance meditation and immune function. So we're moving now to immune function from coronary heart disease. This is a 2003 study by Davidson. Alterations in brain and immune function produced by mindfulness meditation. So this is a Buddhist type. 41 subjects were randomized to either 8 weeks of training in Buddhist mindfulness meditation or a wait list control group. MM subjects had a 3-hour class session once a week, attendance at 7-hour silent retreat during week 6, and hourly sessions at home each day throughout. Again, this is pretty intensive. I've had quite a few patients, and we've had guests up at Highwood Health Centre who talk about going to these silent retreats. You know, you can't say boo, you can't say a thing. And it's part of this mindfulness phenomenon. So what did they find? At the end of 8 weeks, all subjects were vaccinated against influenza, and antibody titers were then measured at 4 and 8 weeks post-vaccination. So this is quite an interesting little study. They got them to do their mindfulness meditation, and their control group basically did nothing. And then they jabbed them with their influenza and checked the antibody titers to see how strong the immune system response was. What do they find? Those in the MM group experienced significantly higher increase in titer between weeks 4 and 8, which we assume indicates that they had a bit stronger immune response. P is reasonable at less than 0.05, so that is a positive result. Okay, now we're going to look at the negatives. So that was a potted summary, some of the best, most recent, high quality studies on trance-based meditation in relation to cancer, coronary heart disease, and immune function. And there are, look, if someone watches this DVD or someone here has studied this in detail, you could probably put your hand up and say, well, I know another really good study that you should have mentioned. Well, there are other studies that are about equivalent. Most of them are older. There are some as well as recent as those. But that is the basic trend of the findings I have found when I've been trawling through these studies. It's a good sample, in my opinion. So we'll have a look at the negatives now. Systematic reviews. Systematic reviews are probably the most seriously reliable type of scientific study you can get. If I am wanting to find out if something is good or not, I will look for, so for example, if I wanted to know if taking garlic every day prevented you getting colds, I would want to go and look for a systematic review on that. And what a systematic review means is that somebody takes all major studies on the subject of whatever it is, like garlic or meditation, and then they do an analysis called a meta-analysis on it and combine all the results together and give you a summary result of whether it's positive or negative. So they're very valuable studies and they're ones to watch out for. There is a couple of systematic reviews that are worth knowing about in relation to trance-based meditation. Ospina and others, June 2007, Meditation Practices for Health, State of the Research. This is a systematic review. What is the state of research in 2007, all research in relation to meditation practices? They're focusing on trance-based meditation. And this is the quote from their abstract. TM, that's why we know it's transcendental meditation or trance-based meditation. TM had no advantage over health education to improve measures of systolic blood pressure and diastolic blood pressure, body weight, heart rate, stress, anger, self-efficacy, cholesterol, dietary intake, and levels of physical activity in hypertensive patients. That was a negative result. There's some other systematic reviews that also give no positive benefit result. This is a 2006 one by this gentleman whose name I will not try and pronounce. Call him Chris and others. Meditation Therapy for Anxiety Disorders, Cochrane Database of Systematic Reviews. They found no significant benefit. This is a negative study in relation to trance-based meditation and substance abuse, and I find this study very fascinating, and it relates to what Mr. Cocteau was talking about yesterday, in my opinion. Spirituality, Mindfulness and Substance Abuse, Addictive Behavior, 2005 study, pretty recent. Lee and colleagues use the Freeberg Mindfulness Inventory to investigate the relationship between mindfulness and substance abuse in 196 college students in Seattle, United States of America. Mindfulness was associated with greater smoking and more frequent binge drinking behavior. So that is interesting, isn't it? This is an abstract, quote from an abstract. Quote, the present study, one, tested the reliability and validity of a new mindfulness measure, the Freeberg Mindfulness Inventory, FMI. Two, explored the relationship between mindfulness and spirituality. And three, investigated the relationship between mindfulness and or spirituality and alcohol and tobacco use in an undergraduate college population of 196 people. Quote, continuing, results support the reliability of FMI and suggest that spirituality and mindfulness may be separate constructs. That's what I've been saying. Faith-based meditation, spirituality would be equivalent to spirituality here, in my opinion, and trance-based meditation. Separate constructs. In addition, smoking and frequent binge drinking were negatively correlated with spirituality scores. As spirituality scores increased, the use of alcohol and tobacco decreased. That's good. Thus, spirituality may be related to decreased substance use. In contrast, a positive relationship between mindfulness and smoking frequent binge drinking behavior was uncovered and warrants further investigation. So that is a very interesting result. I don't recall finding a p-value for this in my research, but it is a very interesting result. So my opinion, could this difference between mindfulness meditation and spirituality have to do with hindbrain and forebrain dominance? You know, if the hindbrain is more to do with sensory apparatus and forebrain with reasoning and thinking and willpower, which is what we're interested in with addictive behavior, then spirituality enhances the willpower, reduced substance abuse. Mindfulness reduces the willpower. And I have often said to patients of mine who've asked me, David, I want to get hypnotized to give up smoking. I want to get hypnotized to help me sleep. I want to get hypnotized to stop drinking. I have said that, in my opinion, hypnosis reduces willpower because someone else is actually taking over your brain for you and doing that. And this is what I've found in patients. It reduces willpower. And mindfulness meditation, as I've shown you, is similar to self-hypnosis. And this supports my clinical anecdotal evidence. What I've found in clinical practice is a decrease in willpower with self-hypnosis, hypnosis, and trance-based meditation. This is another negative study on memory. This was actually a group of three studies done in 1979 and it's quite, as you can see, reading through scientific studies can be quite tedious, but there's no other way to do it. If you want to trawl through this data, you've just got to read it, digest it, and take it on board. So this is quite a long-winded study. I'm going to try and somehow truncate this a bit, but we'll see how we go. Three experiments investigative effects of transcendental meditation on iconic memory. The task involved reporting of digits shown, that's a difficult word, isn't it? Tachyscopically. Yeah, so I think that means they were flashed in front of them, okay? Using Sperling's partial report technique. Experiment one was a pilot study involving a meditation group and a non-meditation group. Now, experiment one was a pilot study, and they actually found in their pilot study that those who did meditation did better, okay? But that was their pilot study. So, results showed that the treatment increased performance in meditators, but not in non-meditators. Okay, so their pilot study was actually positive for meditation and memory. However, listen to what happened. In this experiment, important controls such as individual administration of a task, extrinsic rewards, subject pacing, and adequate practice were lacking. They hadn't control for certain things. Experiment two was a replication of a first with these controls added. The results no longer showed a superiority for the meditation treatment. In fact, the meditation group performed worse on each day of running. Okay? Very interesting, isn't it? This study illustrates some important points. Well, they did another experiment, experiment three, which showed the same thing, that those who were meditating did worse on memory, okay? And they concluded that the performance of the meditators was again significantly lower, okay? This research illustrates the importance of careful control when investigating the effects of meditation on behavior. So the point is, if they had just done that experiment one and left it at that, you'd have had a positive result. So there you go, meditation improves memory. But when they improved the quality of the study, the result turned out negative. That's why we have to look for high quality studies. Okay, we're going to move now on to active meditation, the positive studies. Perhaps I'll mention a note about that memory business and meditation. I believe that memory is also more of a high brain function. So if a high brain is being sort of tranquilized, maybe that's why the memory is not registering as it should. Okay, so this is active meditation and positive results. This is a 1991 study by Paloma and others. The effects of prayer and prayer experiences on measures of general well-being. Journal of Psychology and Theology, 1991. In this study, they talk about a survey of 560 randomly selected households that focused on religiosity and subjective perceptions of well-being, including items measuring the frequency of prayer, prayer experiences and different forms of prayer, together with the more standard measures of religiosity. So basically, it was a pretty in-depth study on the matter of spirituality and religiosity, particularly paying attention to prayer. Frequency of prayer and prayer experiences were among the best predictors of well-being when all other religious measures were controlled. So they were controlling for things in this study. Findings demonstrate that prayer, like its parent concept of religiosity, is clearly multidimensional and contributes to a profiling of well-being. There is one kind of study which is called a case report. Case report studies are fascinating because they often deal with dramatic stuff, as will be illustrated by this. When it comes to dealing with populations of people, though they are considered a less significant result than systematic reviews and controlled trials. But these ones are so fascinating I want to mention them to you. And this is the effect of active meditation, prayer, as it relates to something called spontaneous remission of cancer, SRC for short. There's a famous researcher, a professor and physician, Aikimi, Japanese gentleman, and his colleagues worked at Kyushu University School of Medicine in Japan, and they did a very careful case report studies on 5 cases of SRC. This means that the cancer disappears, okay, completely, and for no apparent reason. It's a well-known phenomena in medicine, and almost every oncologist has people who, it's gone. We don't know why, and they just dismiss it and move on with their practice. Aikimi and his co-workers selected these cases prospectively and unselectively according to strict criteria. This means the researchers did not skim off the top, picking only cases that conformed to their expectations and preconceived ideas. The reports are scientifically precise and include biopsy confirmation of the cancers in question, so they biopsied them. That's how you diagnose cancer, definitely. On balance, these remarkable cases seem to contradict the idea that SRC is accidental, random, and beyond the effects of a patient's thoughts, attitudes, and feelings. They strongly suggest that there is a profound effect on prayerfulness and an indwelling spiritual sense on the cancer process. I'm going to share with you his first case that he did a case report on. Aikimi's first case involved a male church worker who was diagnosed with laryngeal cancer. So this was a cancer of his larynx, the voice box, and when he went to the surgeons, the cancer specialists, they said, we'll do radical surgery, chop out your larynx. Now, that would be major, major surgery. Remember, this was this was in the 1970s, or might have been earlier than that. I'm not sure when this case was, but about around there. So it would have been big, big surgery. He declined radical surgery to remove his larynx. This is God's will, and I have no complaint about it, he felt. Whatever should happen, will just happen. His name was YH. Well, what happened? YH lived for the next 13 years without any form of medical treatment or surgery. Repeated evaluation revealed no evidence of a laryngeal tumor, and he died at 78 from an unrelated cause. So, shortly after he had this resigned prayerfulness, the cancer disappeared. Now, his state of mind was analysed. Following his diagnosis, YH showed no tendency to lapse into depression, despair, lack of motivation, and fear of death. He did not engage in specific prayers in which he pleaded or bargained with God to change the diagnosis and grant him a cure. He did not fight cancer in any ordinary sense of the word, as doctors and others often recommend today. What did he do? His attitude was rather one of renewed commitment and gratitude to God, combined with a belief that God's will was being done no matter what happened. YH's case demonstrated a paradoxical theme that runs through all the examples reported by Akimi, often a prayerful, prayer-like attitude of devotion and acceptance, not robust, aggressive prayer for specific outcomes, including eradication of a cancer, preceded the cure. So this is an interesting form of active meditation with positive results. Okay, let's move on. Active meditation and depression anxiety. Boylan's et al. 2009, this had a quality rating of 6 out of 10. So it was not as high quality as some of our studies, but that's not a bad quality. It's when it gets less than 5, we're really worried. 63 medical patients with either depression or anxiety were randomized to either an in-person prayer intervention by a clinician or to a control condition. Subjects completed Hamilton rating scales for depression and anxiety, etc., and underwent measurement of cortisol levels. So these people had the direct person-to-person prayer contact. What that meant is that the doctor prayed with them. Okay, simple as that. And they received 6 weekly 1-hour prayer sessions, while those in the control group received none. Rating scales and cortisol levels were repeated for both groups after completion of the prayer sessions and a month later. Well, basically, these were the results. At the completion of a trial, participants receiving a prayer intervention showed significant improvement of depression and anxiety, as well as optimism compared to controls. P was very strong on that, less than 0.01 in all cases. Subjects in the prayer group maintained these significant improvements, P 0.01 in all cases, for a duration of at least 1 month after the final prayer session, which is quite significant. So you could argue that the extra contact during the prayer time might be of some significance, but this extended after that contact ceased. Participants in the control group did not show significant changes during the study, and the cortisol levels showed no significant change. PTSD is talked about quite a bit these days, post-traumatic stress disorder. 2010 study, Harris and others, coping functions of prayer and post-traumatic growth. They were interested in people growing mentally and emotionally following traumatic events. And this is what they reported on in their study. Research on prayer and post-traumatic growth indicates that those who pray report more post-traumatic growth. Participants completed questionnaires assessing trauma history, prayer, coping functions, and PTG. Multiple linear regression analyses found that praying for calm and focus was independently related to a high level of PTG. So prayer helps cope with traumatic events. This study, however, had some other interesting aspects. It mentions other positive studies in relation to prayer, and also, interestingly, it mentions negative studies and discusses the possible reasons for the difference, which we will be looking at in a moment. These are the other positive studies mentioned in that paper, which I am not going to go into now. These are all positive studies to do with prayer and mental health. They're pretty recent ones, most of them 2005, 2003, 2000. And they showed that prayer is related to higher levels of social support, reduced depression, improved stress tolerance, purpose in life, and religious satisfaction. And these results were from studies that showed prayer was associated with some negative aspects in mental health. So, and they're all reasonably recent studies as well. And so the results of these studies suggest that certain types of prayer or certain ways you pray may be associated with poorer physical health, increased avoidance, negative emotions, lower levels of life satisfaction, and reduced well-being. Those were the findings from the negative studies, okay? They found that people who were praying got these negative outcomes. And the question that I had from that is, what types of prayer or active meditation may be negative? Well, there was one study, a well-designed study, that has got 8 out of 10. A 2006, which gives at least one answer to this question of positive prayer and negative prayer, and it's a very interesting study. In this study called View of God is Associated with Disease Progression in HIV. So these were patients with AIDS, HIV patients. Ironside and colleagues examined the relationship between view of God, immune function and viral load in 100 persons with HIV, assessed every 6 months for 4 years. What did they find? Results indicated that a negative view of God as judgmental and punishing predicted a faster CD4 plus cell decline. That is a very, very significant p-value. P less than 0.001, and a greater increase in viral load, P less than 0.05. In contrast, a positive view of God as loving and merciful predicted significantly higher CD4 plus, again, significant p-values, and significantly lower viral load. So, your view of God, if you are a praying person, your view of God is very important to your health. In fact, you might be worshipping the wrong God if you don't have the right concept of who God is. This relates directly to what we were talking about yesterday with belief in an ever-burning hell. If you believe in a God who tosses people into an ever-burning hell, praying to a God like that might be a negative health experience. I don't believe in a God who burns people forever and ever in hell, and I don't believe the Bible teaches that. I believe in a God whose primary characteristic is love. This is primary character. He's also holy and majestic, and he does enforce justice, but his primary aspect is love, and he is a loving and merciful God that I pray to. Okay, you've done well to endure through some heavy-duty scientific studies. You know, when you go to doctor continued medical education events, we do this for hours, sit in front of studies. Do this for, talking about studies, so it can be quite tedious, can't it? But look, there's no other way. If you want to see if the studies are going to be of some help in making your mind, you have to use your frontal, you're losing your frontal lobe for this. You can't use trance states for working through this stuff, okay? So this is conclusions. A body of scientific literature exists for both trance and active meditation. The literature can be used to support the idea that either form is beneficial, right? We've demonstrated that. There is also literature suggesting negative aspects to meditation, both trance meditation and if you're praying to the wrong God, it's negative. That was my conclusion. And we've mentioned this before, they're connected to wider religious belief systems and are associated health habits and issues. So, this is what we've just done. We've done the results of scientific studies, and now I'm going to give you a bit of a summary of all three of my talks, particularly focusing on this one. We've done these other two three areas in previous talks. I'm going to give you my observations and opinions. So we showed you this study that illustrated that EEG changes in trance meditation and hypnosis are similar. We also showed you a study, a 2005 study, which showed that spirituality, which is forebrain dominant, was protective for substance abuse, while trance meditation, which is hindbrain dominant, favoured substance abuse. So that was my point I made about willpower, and that is my opinion and conclusion, that activities that promote the dominance of a hindbrain are with the forebrain being in a trance state, shall we say, reduce willpower. This study we discussed about trance meditation showed that it reduced memory performance, so mainly hindbrain function. Does this suggest that trance meditation is a form of escapism? So if you are escaping from reality, from the present world you are in, and going into this trance state, and then you're coming back into the present world, that would affect your memory, right? Oh, I'm back in the present world. Where was I? What do I do? What was I doing? Okay, that is why I believe trance-based meditation is a form of escapism that is reducing memory function. So, unlike trance meditation, active meditation is analyzing, it's looking for solutions to life's problems. It's receiving information from God through His Word, and also comfort from praying to Him. And this helps you to address life's challenges, and it is not escaping, a form of escaping from them. And we mentioned this, if you something that is otherwise positive, you can turn into something negative if you have a view of God as primarily punishing a judgmental tyrant, which unfortunately you can either inherit that idea from parental influences or through theology. Those are the two main ways that you can get a negative view of God, if your parents are giving you a negative view of God by their behavior, and from theology, wrong theology. There is one big advantage of trance-based meditation that I haven't mentioned. I don't think it's an advantage, but many people in the secular world think it is. In trance-based meditation, you do not have to have a boss. You can be your own boss. You do not have to be answerable to a higher power, to a God, to God, to a creator. And so, like the theory of evolution, which does away with the need to be responsible to morally to God, so in trance-based meditation, you do not have that responsibility. And that is why it's appealing to secular people to get rid of the religious element, or have a religious element that is very watered down and mystical, that doesn't involve a personal God, just a pantheistic God or a nirvana experience. That is attractive to many people today. And the number one thing that scares people off trying faith-based meditation is this. If I want to try faith-based meditation, I'm going to have to be responsible to God. And that's scary, because they don't want to own up to that feeling of responsibility. However, I really think they are looking at it from a negative point of view. Because for me, the idea is, yes, I am responsible to God, but God's responsible to me as well. He looks after me. I am under His protection. I'm under His care. I'm under his guardianship. He is my loving Heavenly Father, and he is caring for me. It's just like having a loving father or mother on earth that you can trust. So I want to mention this. It does boil down to your choice, because God won't force you into faith-based meditation. But there are problems with trance-based meditation that you need to be aware of. Thank you for your attention this afternoon, and may you be guided in your decisions.